Good day or good evening, whichever the case may be for you. Last time in 1 Samuel 5 through 6, we learned about the adventures of the Ark in the land of the Philistines. Everywhere it went, there was destruction. First it was a destroyed idol of Dagon, then it was rats and bubonic plague. After 7 months of this, they decided their trophy of conquest over Israel was more trouble than it was worth. So they sent the Ark back to Israel, and after a brief layover in Beth Shemesh, it found a new home in Kiriath Jearim. It did not go back to Shiloh because that city had since been destroyed. In the beginning of chapter 7, it says that all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. It's unclear what time frame this is and what prompted the lamenting, but Samuel takes advantage of this attitude to tell them what they need to do. They need to get rid of those foreign gods and get serious about serving only Jehovah. Now, we haven't brought up the cycle of shame lately, but there may have been some oppression at the time, because Samuel says if they do put away the false gods, God will deliver them from the Philistines. Verse 4 says the sons of Israel put away the Baals and the Ashtaroths, which is likely some campaign of purging their homes and high places. Samuel calls for a national assembly at Mizpah, which is a few miles north of Jerusalem. At this assembly, they have a ceremony which involves pouring water out before the Lord. It's uncertain what this ritual is about. Perhaps it symbolizes pouring out their souls. It also says they fasted and confessed their sins, and Samuel had early said that he would pray for them. Now we know that Israel gathered together for the purpose of repentance, but the Philistines did not know that. They assumed Israel gathered to go to war against them. So the Philistines mustered their army and approached near enough to be visible, which caused fear in Israel. It's possible that they are unarmed or lightly armed, in which case they are at a decided disadvantage against the mighty Philistines. However, they are now right with God, so they're actually in quite good shape. Samuel is not Joshua. He is not leading the army. Yet Israel relies on him with this statement: "Do not cease to cry out to the Lord our God for us, that he may save us from the hand of the Philistines." Samuel offers a burnt offering and cries out to the Lord, who answers with a thunder that confuses the Philistines. This confusion leads to a rout, and Israel gives chase as far as some place named Beth Kar. Now, to commemorate this victory, Samuel sets up a stone near Mizpah and names it Ebenezer, which means the stone of help. Samuel says, "Thus far, the Lord has helped us." And most of you are probably now thinking of the song, "O Thou Fount of Every Blessing," which references this event in verse 2. "Here I raise my Ebenezer, hither by thy help I've come." Now, the win of the Philistines had very little detail, but was evidently a huge momentum shifter. Much like after Marty McFly knocked out Biff, everything changed. Israel recaptured some cities that the Philistines had previously taken, and the Philistines did not encroach onto Israel's land, at least not while Samuel was around. Chapter 7 concludes with Samuel's travel circuit to Bethel, Gilgal, and Mizpah, and back home to Ramah. This was an unusual time in Israel. The Ark was gone, but now it's back. But if our theory about Shiloh is right, there was no more tabernacle. The Ark sat in someone's house in Judah, but we don't see it being used as a central place of worship. It's like there is no central place of worship right now. So when it says Samuel built an altar in Ramah to the Lord, I have to assume God's okay with it. We also see that he offered the sacrifice earlier in the chapter. Ordinarily, this is not the way it would have been, but it seems that the prescribed order is sort of suspended right now. Why are they not trying to rebuild the tabernacle immediately? I don't know. But it's a long time before the temple is built. So I don't have a really great answer there, but that's the way it was. As we open chapter 8, some time has passed because Samuel is now old and has delegated duties to his sons. But his sons are crooks. So the demand comes from the elders of Israel to Samuel: "Give us a king." What's their official reason? "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways." What is perhaps their real reason? "Like all the nations." Understandably, Samuel is upset by this demand. Personally, it's an indictment against him and his sons. And he didn't have much defense on that front. But beyond that, it was not how God had chosen to organize his people. It was on purpose that Israel had occasional judges, not kings. Israel was different from every other nation. Israel was God's people. He was their king. God tells Samuel that the nation is rejecting him, God, more so than Samuel. If anyone should feel insulted, it's God. He tells Samuel, though, he's not one bit surprised, considering the nation's distinguished history of rejecting him. So now you, Samuel, know how I have felt for centuries. God tells Samuel to give them their request, but warn them first. So Samuel tells them, be careful what you ask for, you just might get it. The situations he described for them all amount to the king taking their family members and their food to support his big government. Now, the people think Samuel's just a crazy conspiracy theorist, and they refuse to be swayed by what he has told them, and they repeat their demand for a king. So when Samuel consults with God again, he gives them over to their wishes and says, listen to their voice and appoint them a king. So that narrative was fairly short, but there's so many applications to pull from this chapter. And I'll go back to the family matters. One of the sad things you'll see in family life is when one generation makes a mistake, and the next generation repeats it. Eli may have been good, but his sons were reprobates. Samuel was a foster son of Eli and got to see firsthand the heartache that Hophni and Phinehas caused Eli. He also got to see the ineffective discipline of Eli, which probably contributed to his sons being the way they were. You would think Samuel learned some things to keep that from happening to him as a father. But in the end, unfortunately, Samuel had the same issues with his sons that Eli had with his, although we don't see God judging Samuel the same way he judged Eli. On a positive note, it seems that one of Samuel's grandsons made something of himself. 1 Chronicles 6, verse 33, Heman, the son of Joel, the son of Samuel, is listed as a singer, one of the men whom King David put in charge of the service of song in the house of the Lord. So it's also possible for your son to turn out better than you. That's reassuring. God told Samuel that their request for a human king was ultimately a rejection of God as their ruler. And Jesus said a similar thing in Luke 10 and verse 16. The one who listens to you listens to me, and the one who rejects you rejects me, and he who rejects me rejects the one who sent me. And that's a lesson for us. If friends or family don't accept what we present them from God's word, we need not take it personally. Need not let that discourage us from telling them anyway. But here's the thing, God had actually seen this event coming long before. 350 years earlier, when Moses delivered Deuteronomy, he had said this in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who live around me, then you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. So was God really okay with the whole king idea since he was already setting up guidelines in Deuteronomy? No. God hates divorce. We know that from Malachi 2. Yet he set up regulations in the law that allowed divorce. So why did he do that? Jesus told the people that it was because of the hardness of their heart. I think you can make the same application here. It was not God's desire for Israel to have an earthly king, but because of the hardness of their hearts, he allowed them to have one. And prophet Hosea spoke for God in Hosea 8, verse 4, when he said, they have set up kings, but not by me. God will sometimes give you what you ask for, even when it's not his desire. But when your way ends in failure, he can use that as a way to demonstrate how his wisdom is better than yours, and that you need to do it his way next time. Another thing we see from this chapter 8 in particular is that some conspiracy theories are true. In this case, it was a prophecy, though not a conspiracy theory as such. All these things that Samuel said the king would do were done by one or more kings and reached its apex during the reign of Solomon. 1 Kings 4, verse 26 mentions 40,000 stalls of horses for chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Few verses earlier, it lists the daily provisions for Solomon and his staff. Now, where do you suppose all that stuff came from? From 1 Kings 5:13, there were 30,000 forced laborers, plus another 150,000 just for quarrying stone. Solomon took 7 years to build the temple, and another 13 years to build the palace. The human toll was just amazing. And it's no wonder that after Solomon died, the people begged Rehoboam to give it a rest. It may have sounded crazy to the people in Samuel's day that a king would do all that he was saying, but it was all true. And finally, there's the inherent danger of what everyone else is doing. We're seeing that with this whole virus panic. I could say a lot more, but I need to stay on track. What was Israel revealing by saying they wanted a king like all the other nations? They didn't like being different. Every other nation had a king, but since when has the majority ever been right? Jesus used many different analogies in his preaching to show that only a very few will be saved. Not that a majority cannot be saved, just that the majority are not willing to do what God requires to be saved. Do we like being different? Not really. It can be uncomfortable, awkward, when everyone else dresses one way and you dress modestly. Or when some friends want you to go to a particular movie, but you say, I don't think I should watch that. You can think of plenty of other examples of peer pressure and having to not fit in with everybody else. Well, here's how Peter put it in 1 Peter 2, verses 9 through 12. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. We're to be different and not doing what everyone else is doing. So, the particular man has yet to be selected, but the decision has been made. Israel will have a king. The period of judges is over, and they're about to enter the period of monarchy. It was a monarchy that would eventually ruin Israel. As the Lord expressed it long afterward when the monarchy had run its evil course, I will destroy you, O Israel. Who can help you? Where now is your king that he may save you in all your cities? And your judges, of whom you requested, give me a king and princes. I gave you a king in my anger, and I took him away in my wrath. That's Hosea 13, verses 9 through 11. Ordinarily, a new quarter with a new topic would begin on April 5th, but it looks like that might not happen. So unless something changes in the next week or a giant hook yanks me off the stage, I'll plan to continue the historical track and go into Saul's reign. There's a lot to be learned from his life and watching the evolution of his reign and his person. Thanks again for listening to these podcasts, and I hope to see you all soon.